I may need to like pick them up and put them down at some point if they jump up here, but I've like moved everything. So hopefully it's fine.
For those just joining us, you're talking about your cats.
I am talking. It's all I ever talk about.
Okay. No, I just want to make sure people who coming in on pick them up, put them down and all that. I just want people to know what the hell we're talking about. How you doing, Roxanna?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm lovely. I'm really, really great.
Wonderful.
I can't. I have to have surgery and I have to wait to have it for like a month and a half until the surgeon can like get to me. And it's my first time with that experience where it's like, you really need to have this done. And I'm like, great. And they're like, yeah, but yeah, until you just have to deal with it until December.
Yeah. If you want to talk about the American healthcare system for an hour and a half, if there's one thing I can complain about for a lengthy amount of time, it's things like this. I'm so sorry, dude.
I just had to get honest for a second about how you're doing. That's how I'm doing. And so I got my knees all fucked up. And yeah, we could totally talk about that for a really long time. I think an hour and a half is an undersell on the time we could fill, I'm sure, based on your tone.
That is real. That is real.
100%. All right. Well, that's not really why people are here, I don't think. If we really have to go there, we'll go there. But we should give context. I always like to give context. I don't know you at all, really. We talked briefly when I was planning my wedding about photography.
We did. Yeah.
That was a thing. And I ended up hiring somebody local to Colorado, which I didn't think I would be able to do. And that's why I was talking to you. But I ended up finding someone there. But that is like the limit. That's all we know about each other is, you know, I had a wedding. And I know that
I also know you have a podcast. So that's,
yeah,
that's that. All I got.
Yeah. All right. So cool. And I know that, you know, we went to the same school and you are clearly a talented photographer. I don't even know. Are you a cinematography major at school?
I'm an editor.
See? I don't even fucking know that.
Yeah, no, it's kind of left field to keep doing the photography thing, but I couldn't let it go. So I didn't.
I mean, it's no more left field than reality TV producing when I used to make theater and be all up my ass about the classics and conservatism. And now I make like what some people refer to as trash TV and I refer to as my income. Things change.
Yeah, I know. I think when you go to a school where there's a very, you know, you can major in, for example, specifically props.
Right.
People get real, real specific. And I'm not shocked when they leave school and end up doing either a wider variety of things or something totally different.
This is a recurring theme on the show lately. We've been talking about this a lot and we're going to get to the where are you from, which is usually the beginning. We're going to get to that. But while we're on this, I want to hit this. So you're absolutely right. And I talk to probably drama students the most because that was the school I graduated from, even though I started in DMP originally. And I applied to film and then pulled my application. So those are the three places that I was like, couldn't make up my mind about. And I ended up where I ended up. But the thing that I love about DMP and film is that it is this kind of brilliant modern and conservatory blend attitude of you really start with fundamentals and they take that really seriously and you don't mm-hmm. really get to be focused, which is what conservatory is typically about. You don't get to do that until later down the road once they all agree that we're speaking the same language. And I think that's, it makes it a lot easier for those departments versus dance and drama and music, I think, in my experience, it makes it a little bit easier to get out of school and pivot or find something slightly different because you've already kind of got it in your working brain of like, oh, I do a bunch of different shit.
Yeah.
Like I can do a few things. Now I spent extra time on editing, but it's not mm-hmm. like you didn't learn about cameras. It's not like you didn't learn about focal length and lenses and all that kind of jargon. It's like, that's just going to happen if you weren't already paying attention to that before school, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you get out and you pivot and it's easier, but where you're a drama student and you're like, I'm an actor or I'm a oboe player or I'm a ballet dancer or when you have these far more linear things, and a lot of them have been doing shit since they were 10, not since they were 15 or whatever. It's like, you get way more laser focused. And then when you get out and you need to pivot to, I don't know, pay bills or some shit, it's like this it's like this big failure to a lot of them that I don't feel like we deal with in the same way, because we kind of have those roots of like, oh no, I'm building a toolkit, a skill set. I can do all kinds of shit. So how did you end up? So let's talk about, we'll go backwards. We'll Tarantino it. So let's start with, let's start with the end of the story of like, you're out of school with an editing degree, and how long have you been out?
So I graduated in 2019.
Yeah. So not super long.
Yeah, no, I moved to LA like less than 2 months after graduating, and I've been here for a little over 4 years. So.
And what has made up your, what has made up your time as far as work while you've been out here?
So when I first moved, I was really lucky. We had a guest professor named Imbal Lesner who came and taught in the editing department at my school. And we took a liking to each other. And I was convenient enough. It was really nice that she then got to teach her future AE Avid. So I, unbeknownst to me at the time, when she was teaching me Avid, there was a little bit of a, maybe I could hire this girl after she graduated. And sure enough, less than 7 days after graduation, this woman who continues to improve my life and make the biggest impact on me of basically any adult ever, she was able to hire me. And then I was post PA. Yeah, she's incredible. Like, if she's the best. I could make this a whole podcast about how much I love Inbal Lesner, but I won't.
Oh, it's all good. I mean, credit where credit's due. That shit is really important. And where you end up and what you do has a lot to do with the springboard that you are or are not offered out of a school like that. When a school is so small, it almost feels like, where's my fucking springboard? Like, if you go to a school for like 60,000 people or whatever, like, that's different to expect that every kid's going to get some push or some hand or something. But like, with a school as small as School of the Arts, like less than 1,500 kids every year, like, give everybody something to go to. And it seems to mostly happen. Mostly.
Yeah. I think it's hard because I think a lot of people, the energy surrounding UNCSA is half of the people come in expecting a university experience and half the people come in expecting a conservatory experience.
Why do you think people are so confused?
I think because of this negative, the way that we so negatively speak about things like trade school. And typically, especially in North Carolina, I'm not sure. Are you from North Carolina?
No, I'm from Texas.
Oh, I love that for you. I am very from North Carolina.
Well, I lived there for longer than most people who went to that school. I ended up living there for like 7 years.
Really?
Yeah, big long chunk. So I spent like a whole year getting in-state tuition where I didn't go to school. And then I was there for 4 years of school. Then I left for a little bit and I came back and taught at the school and in High Point and stuff like that. So
wow,
I've spent a lot. I consider North Carolina like definitely one of my other homes. I live there longer than I've lived in LA almost. I'm getting close to the same amount.
Oh, so I think that counts. I think you're from North Carolina.
Hey,
now in my head.
I had to get the state considered me a citizen because they gave me the break on tuition.
I was about to say, you did it right. Like, you figured out where you wanted to go and you found out how to get to go there for less money. Like,
well, and we don't need to go into this, and I don't know how it works now, but I feel like we're probably what's the word I'm looking for? Not politically, but like agenda wise on the same page socially, because I've got a lot of gripes about how that whole system works of paying for the school. And for those that don't know, and I've talked about this before and I breeze over it every time. I don't know if I've ever gone into detail. I'm not going to like super go into detail now. But if you live in a state like Texas, you basically need an address for a period of time. And then you can go to the state and be like, hey, I live here. And they go, oh, you're in state. Great. Here's a break on tuition. And in Texas, it's not huge, but you get a little break. In North Carolina, and I didn't, how the fuck would anyone know this until you tried to go to school there? It's not a common thing. In North Carolina, they're like, if you're out of state, it's expensive as shit to go to schools that are state schools, UNC, Chapel Hill, School of the Arts, whatever. If you want to go to school here from out of state, it's expensive. If you're from North Carolina, we're going to give you like a 68% break on tuition.
It
cuts your shit down to a third of the price. And I don't know what it is now, but that's what it was when I went to school 10 plus years ago. But here's the thing. Can't just have that address for 6 months or whatever the fuck. You got to do all of it. You've got to get your driver's license, pay taxes, get a job. You can't live on campus because you got to pay local, real estate taxes, whatever, even if it's rent. You can't get any money from your family. If that shows up in your bank account, you have to prove that you're not getting money from outside of the state. Your parents can no longer claim you on their taxes. You have to do your taxes in North Carolina fully by yourself. There's a list of like 10 things. And I had other people.
I had no idea.
Who coached me on this so that I could accomplish it and afford to go to school there. Because I didn't have family support for college. And so I was paying for it fully on my own. But until you're 24, the government doesn't care what your situation is with your family. If you have biological family and they are alive, you have to put them on your FAFSA application and tell the government how much money they make. And that determines how much financial aid you get. Even if they're like, fuck you, we're not giving you any money.
That's messed up.
Yeah.
Mary.
So it's weird too, because we talk a lot about, how the system is overpriced. And I think that that's totally a thing. And then we have so many conversations about the debt, which is true, but it's like, we also have all this weird red tape that makes it really hard for like earnest kids who want a good education, who got into a dope ass school too, that doesn't take everybody. It's like, why should those kids, it's like when they pay for everyone to go to like grad school somewhere, but even a school like this, it's like, you really should just help the kids go to school there. They have already proven that they work hard. I talk to the international kids about this all the time.
Well, we do have, so this is, as someone who was born and raised in North Carolina and has multiple posters behind this computer about it actually currently.
Which city, actually, now that we've gotten to the, where are you from?
Cary, North Carolina.
I know where Cary is.
Really? Cary, no one knows where Cary is. Yes. What?
Cary with a C, baby.
How do you know where Cary with a C is?
You're outside the triangle, are you not?
Yes.
Yeah. I told you, I'm part Carolinian over here. I'm part
Cackle-whack. I was about to say, the only people who know about Cary have spent a suspiciously long amount of time in North Carolina. I'm a little scared of you now, but I'm just going to move past that.
I spent a year working in Winston, and I worked at IHOP, the one on like Silas Creek.
Yeah.
And the whole year I lived there, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah, there was a couple kids from school, but man, I spent a year like elbow to elbow with people from North Carolina, and they were all, you know, they would be from all over the place. And one of my homies, Chris, who worked with me in the kitchen, he was from Cary. That's how I know where that is.
That's so cool.
It's you know, you're not the only one who got out.
You know, sometimes I feel like that, but there's others.
You both only made it to Winston so far as the story can tell. So, you know, where we're at,
that
but
is
then
true.
Eventually to LA. So there you go.
That is true. The best compliment I was ever given was by Ray in the mailroom at UNCSA. He said, where are you from? I said, Cary, North Carolina. He said, dang, I never would have guessed. You're nothing like Cary. And I was like, I made it. This is
That's
it.
That's pretty good.
This is the best compliment of my life. No, but
I'm so curious if he really knew the city or if he was trying to reference the Stephen King character.
I think he was referencing the entitlement from the majority of people from my hometown, which
talk
is,
to me about Cary and the entitlement from your hometown.
Yes.
Let's go.
I'm just going to start with, I am glad I grew up in Cary. I am first generation on one side, and my father literally picked Cary because it was the safest city in the country he could find. It's not a city, it's a town, but safest place in the country he could find. Somehow looked that up, saw this little place called Cary, North Carolina, and was like, guess I'm immigrating there. And then moved there. So it is a much better situation than growing up in Iran for many reasons. But sure. There are also definitely some interesting parts. What I was going to say about the college thing, which is weird, is the high school I went to was either the first or the second like best high school in North Carolina. It was a public school. I just happened to grow up 5 minutes from there. That's the only reason why I went. You didn't get accepted or whatever. This was a problem because as someone who excelled in the arts, but was not terrible at school, the classes we offered something insane, like 16 AP courses, but the average person would graduate with about three. Most of my friends.
You say average person or average Persian?
Person. I was the only Persian.
Okay.
So we didn't even get any other ones.
Hit the ear. It hit the ear. I just continue.
No, you're all good. The average Persian only took two. So,
right.
but we just had so many kids took so many AP courses to the point that our average weighted GPA was a 4.5. So it was an extremely, a school filled with a lot of academic pressure. Because of that, we had a lot of extremely talented, intelligent people from my school who have gone on to do amazing things like be heart doctors and all this stuff. Like, they're incredible people, and I wish nothing but the best for them. That being said, North Carolina schools only accept a certain amount of North Carolina people. I think it's about, they can't do like over, at least when I was applying to schools, I think it was like they couldn't do over 60% of the school could only be from North Carolina or something. So
they couldn't afford it.
Yeah, no, because they need the income from other people. And North Carolina is littered with really incredible schools. Like, we have a lot of great ones. Like, we have
some
this
hidden
little
gems, some really famous. It's absolutely true. That's like one of the things, which is so funny because North Carolina public education is like 43rd or something like that. Like, it's not overall, it's rated terribly. Some of the best colleges in the country. Chapel Hill to A&T, like so many good schools for so many different things.
Exactly. I love telling people about my school because they don't even know it exists. And I'm like, yeah, Danny McBride went there. And also we have like a 98% employment rate out of school.
So yeah.
Like, you know, whatever, 4% acceptance rate, whatever. It's nothing. Third best drama school in the world. It's just, don't,
nobody cares.
You know, it's tiny, whatever. No one cares.
And you know, if I'm being totally honest with you, I am obsessed with that part. It is one of my favorite things about going to school there because if I went to Juilliard, I wouldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I would be like, I went to drama school. It's like if you go to Harvard and then you tell people you went there, like, shut the fuck up. You went to college. Yeah. You sound like an asshole. Like, just
exactly.
Just say you went. Don't, like, it's the bigger deal your school is, the less cool it is to fucking ever say you went there. So we get this dope ass education and people are like, where'd you go? And you're like, UNCSA. And they're like, I don't know. And you're like, yeah, it's a good school.
It's crazy, though, because like at least in the editing, you know, world of film, how do I say this? We're a lot better. Then we exit school a lot more prepared than a lot of different schools because we teach Avid. It's such a simple thing, but so many colleges just don't teach the most important and most like popular editing software in
film.
What
are they just teaching, Adobe shit or what?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. So we're one of the only schools that proficiently teaches Avid. So we're one of the only schools where you can graduate and immediately get a job as an AE because you actually know Avid. So it's crazy because like, yeah, we're from this
nothing community
school.
Of editors is so small and it is such in high demand, especially in the unscripted world. Oh my God.
Yeah.
The amount of work.
Yeah.
So much work.
So much drama though about like unscripted versus scripted. I just flipped into scripted right before the strike.
Yeah.
So I have firsthand dealt with a lot of this stuff in terms of like the social pressure, but also the pay difference and, you know, the fact that one of them gets you health insurance, the other doesn't.
Go on.
Oh, goodness. I could talk about this forever. So essentially,
I think this is a good thing to talk about because I don't get to talk to. No, I don't get to talk to a lot of film editors or TV editors. And I actually work hand in hand with editors all the time. It's one of the few things it's one of the few things that is taught at school, the school that we went to, that I cross over with professionally because I don't work with any fucking actors. I don't, or like, no, but I don't work dancer. I used to work with dancers on when I worked on Dancing with the Stars. That was my closest, like, kind of
so cool.
Doing an artsy thing. But now I don't work with that at all. And so it's like actual editors are the people that I work with all the time back and forth. So for those, can we lay it out a little bit layman's from the beginning as far as like the difference between union, non-union, and kind of scripted, unscripted? Like, what is that dichotomy as you're leaving school? And what are you thinking about that as far as like, what did they tell you versus what are you actually experiencing and all that?
100%. So I am super down to talk about this because legitimately, if there is one thing I have struggled with in my career, it's coming to terms with the fact that I don't want to make documentaries anymore.
Oh, shit. Okay. I love this. Go on.
Yeah. I have literally wanted to make documentaries since I was 11 years old. Edited a documentary when I was 11 years old. It was about local produce. It's terrible, but I made it and I was proud of it. And it screened at a little festival. And I was like, I'm going to edit documentaries. That's it. I was 11. I was like, I'm going to go to film school. This is what I'm going to do with my life. Like,
did you direct it?
I believe.
Like, did you make it or you just cut it?
It was a group of five of us.
Okay.
I believe that I was listed as the producer, but we were kids. So everyone did everything. Right. You know what I mean?
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I just want to get an idea of the ownership of this produce doc that you started with.
Oh, in my brain, it's just mine. Like, in my mind, those avocados, I did the research. They were $3 and I'm the one that knew that. Like,
yeah, you carried it on your back. I know you did. I believe you.
Exactly.
Let's go. All right, what's next?
So I wanted to do this, right? I was really passionate about it. And as I got older and started learning about the injustices of women of color and, you know, Indigenous people who are missing and murdered and, you know, anyone, gay people, obviously I am one. And like, it's all of these things that made up who I was, how many of them were getting murdered and butchered and stolen and raped and all of that stuff. And I was like, this is what I need to do. What I've been called to do with my life is tell documentary storytelling, you know, about parts of me that are not mentioned in the media. So I was super sold on this. Part of the reason Imbal and I really hit it off is she's an incredible documentary filmmaker. She's an editor, but she now show runs. And I believe she writes as well. She's just an all around badass. And she met me. And the fact that I was so open about actually wanting to do docs in a world in which docs aren't even really taught at UNCSA, I think she kind of latched onto that. Because it was genuine. It was a genuine want to go into documentary work. I also did not know about how complicated this stuff can get when you actually get into the industry. And I'm just going to speak from a post standpoint because that's all I know. But when I came out here and I started working in docs, it was a really good way to get my hours because I was able to work myself up from being a post PA to being an AE in less than like 4 months.
Second, because I'm going to lay some stuff out just for people listening who maybe don't get the jargon.
Of course.
You just said you're getting your hours, which I believe you mean your hours to make you eligible to join the union, correct?
Correct. Correct.
And when you said post PA, you mean a post production assistant, which is essentially the most entry level job you can get in an edit house where a bunch of things are being edited. The post PA is running around mostly like taking drives from one place to another, signing things in. What else are you doing in that post PA gig?
I was doing a lot of, so I worked for an individual project. I didn't work for an actual post-production house. I was hired by the editor to, I did stuff like, oh, see, this is where it gets juicy. Because what you would think a post PA does is only running errands, doing crafty, getting everyone lunch, getting coffee, making sure the computers are turned on in the morning, stuff like that.
You're the office PA for the post department.
Exactly.
Correct. What were you doing?
On day one, I was in the AVID. So I showed up and on day one was logging. Not cutting. I was just logging, which is when we go through the footage and mark what's important for the editor to then go pull. I was able to do that because in unscripted, there are no rules preventing PAs from actually being in the AVID. If you work on a union production, you can't even touch the computer if you're a PA.
And I would say this is a good opportunity as well to extend to anyone curious about it. That is very much how everything in the union works, from cameras to audio equipment to everything. If it is an unscripted thing, the PA can be told, go pick that camera up and bring it to this tripod. On a union set, they legally cannot touch the fucking camera at all. They are not allowed.
I learned yesterday that the costume department, the costume PA, can't touch the clothes.
Yeah.
Like they can't even like put them on hangers. wild. Like I did not know just how intense it got in Union, but.
And I think it's worth pointing out that like anything in this life, and I'm not taking a stand against unions. I love the unions. I'm very pro-union. But like anything, when you go to regulate something, there's such a thing as like overregulation and taking things too far. And anytime people organize and regulate, that there's going to be examples of that in extreme ways. But every single one of those regulations and every single piece of red tape that we run into in this conversation that we're having is a result of something that took place somewhere on some set in some house in some office where a fuck up was happening. And they then were like, ah, you know what? We need a rule so that this stops happening. That gets a little out of control sometimes, but by and large, it's a good idea to have fucking rules.
Yeah. Well, I think a long time ago, I was really upset at that because I was like, if you're a post PA and you want to work, you should, you know, be able to go into the AVID. And my understanding was they set these rules so PAs don't mess up. I now, after the experiences I've had, have realized it's so you're not doing AE work with a PA rate.
That's right. It's about money.
Yeah, because there's so many people that are so eager to work that what they end up doing is they go take a post PA job. They say, hey, you can cut. And then they end up doing so much assistant editor work with a minimum wage, you know, paycheck. And then these people can get away with it. They don't need to hire another AE. And I obviously this happened to me. If you can't tell by everything I'm saying, but luckily I had a crew who liked me and was invested in me as a person, not me as an AE, not me as someone who wanted to be an editor, not me as a post PA, me as Roxy, a human who they care about. And so I was able to actually get the role change because day one I was in AVID. And after about 2 weeks, I was like, I'm not a post PA.
When you when you talked to them about the title change, did that come with a rate change also?
I'm gonna skip this one.
That's okay. I will tell a little of my personal story that's almost just like that, that I can tell that maybe we'll fill in the gap. And I think this is part of what we're talking about because here's the thing, you're right. On a union gig, you are more protected in a bunch of different ways. The project is more protected in a bunch of different ways. It is also massively more expensive to buy those protections. You are paying for all of that safety and protection for the gig and for the workers.
Yeah.
It also, one of the cons, one of the drawbacks we were just talking about, where these rules kind of get out of control because we can't fix every fucking problem. One of the drawbacks is there's not a lot of room for movement on this ladder because the rungs of it are so tight and you're not allowed to touch the other ones while you're on this one. If it's a little more Wild West, if the rules are a little looser, that's how a guy who went to drama school for directing theater gets to learn how a camera works.
Yeah.
I got to learn how to shoot and got to shoot shots that aired on television.
That's so cool.
Just a few years out of school because I stood next to a producer as another producer and we're just fucking all producers. And he's like, hey, man, you want to learn how a camera works? I'm like, yeah. When I was working on Showtime at the Apollo, which they tried to reboot a while ago, I was brought in as a logger, not even a post PA or an AE. They just called me a logger. They're paying me like, I don't know, $700 a week or some shit. It was like nothing. It was PA rate. But I was at one point doing network notes in the edit with a union editor over their shoulder going over the notes and picking shots. And I'm like, I'm a post AP. I'm a story AP. That's what I'm doing right now. Story associate producer. And what we're talking is a bunch of jargon. These are just titles that are assigned to roles and responsibilities, essentially. And I went to the EPs. This was a season one show. They're trying to figure out the whole damn thing. And I said, look, I hadn't gotten an AP credit yet at all. And I went to them and I was like, look, just give me the title. We hadn't put out a single episode. Nothing had aired. I said, on all these episodes of this first season, Just call me an AP.
Yeah.
You can keep paying me as a logger. I'll take the minimum wage. I took it. And they said, fucking yeah. Who cares what we write on the thing?
Yep.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Give it to him. He'll do that job for that rate, of course. But then I never went back from AP ever again. It solidified. And then on the next gig, I got an AP rate. And then I hit against that wall for years, trying to make it to field producer or whatever the other gig I was trying to get.
Yeah.
And it's about that room they give you on the ladder to move. And sometimes you got to take one in the fucking whatever once so that you can. And that's kind of the benefit of the non-union world.
No, that's exactly what I did. I ended up keeping my PA rate, but I told them to give me a full AE credit. And they said that I deserved it and that they'd be okay with that. That's how I got my union hours. That's how I got into the union. And I haven't been a PA since.
I don't have a problem with that. Ethically, I don't have a problem with that. I don't think anything wrong happened there. Because also, here's the thing. It's lower risk for them to hire you at that first gig. And yeah, maybe you deserve the money, but they didn't fucking know that for sure. You were untested. Yeah. You're green. You had a shit resume that only had school on it. And so you're like, that's a gamble. And it was the same thing for me working as that logger. They didn't know that I could do producer notes with the editor until I got in there. I started working with them and I proved myself. And then they were like, all right, here's the deal. We'll give you the vouch. That's what it is. We'll give you the fucking letter of recommendation, which in most professions is a big deal. In our profession, it doesn't exist unless you're like taking over a company or something. Like, and in that, they're going to talk to them. They're not going to want a fucking letter. Like,
yeah,
it's just, I think it's okay. I think it's okay that it works that way, especially at a lower level. But the problem is when it gets done over and over and they're like, Roxy, come back next season and do the fucking PA rate AE thing again. That's when you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I already proved it. No. Now you got to pay me. And that's when it's tough for you because then you have to say, sounds like you can't afford me now.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's hard to go forward from there and say stuff like that. But I will say that crew, I have amazing relationships with all of them. We still text. Like, we have a group chat. It's been 4 years. Like, it was such a good experience. Yeah, I loved them. And it was a good show. There were some really hard times because COVID hit halfway through it. And we ended up finishing the film at home. There were days I would work from, I'm not kidding, 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. With no overtime because it was unscripted. And it got really hard for me, but it is the product I'm most proud of everything I've ever worked on. It's the crew I'm happiest I've worked with anyone I've ever worked on. And it is the reason that I tell people, I would suggest going into unscripted instead of doing something like getting your hours at a trailer house, getting your hours working on something else. I always tell people go the documentary or go the reality route because I learned how to be an AE for an entirely different kind of film. And now those skills come into play when I work in scripted. There's something called Script Sync. It's a software in which we go through. And every time someone says, and then, you know, we mark it. I am 10 times faster at that because I worked in unscripted because that's what I had to do. We call it Frankenbiting. I would have to Frankenbite all these sentences together, not in malicious ways, but sometimes these victims and telling their stories would be, let's say, grammatically incorrect. And we don't want to make them look like they don't know how to speak on a show in which they are sharing a very vulnerable story. So a lot of my job is to go Frankenbite together to make sure their sentence is coherent so their story comes across as genuinely as possible. We're not over here doing like trying to manipulate their story. It's genuinely.
You are not.
I'm not. Yeah. So it's, I'm faster at that because I did unscripted. And when I moved into scripted, it was a skill set I had that a lot of other people did not have. So I am very grateful for my time in unscripted. I still love documentaries, but I had some health emergency situations in which medical bills were piling up. And it became really obvious to me really quickly that some people can make the decision to tell the stories they want to tell and some people cannot. And I, unfortunately, I'm someone that has to prioritize my physical being and ability to function in the world over the content that I grew up wanting to make. And I have found ways to tell stories through scripted that get across the same message that I wanted to sell with documentary work. And I'm actually able to enjoy documentaries now. I developed really bad secondhand trauma from watching all of the unedited footage of these atrocities. And after a couple of years of being out of it, now I can actually watch docs and get the same feelings I got from them originally and care about the stories in the way I used to, instead of watching it and being like, I can't do this right now. It got to a point I couldn't watch movies. So I can finally watch movies again. I can finally enjoy film again.
I love that.
Yeah, I couldn't. I got to a point that I didn't like movies anymore. And there was a joke in my household in which Roxy hates plot. And anytime anything happened in a film that was slightly, you know, shifted the energy of the film, everyone's like, we can't watch this. Roxy hates plot. And I'm like, I don't want to think about conflict. So I couldn't watch movies for like a year, because I would go to work, watch footage of women being, insert every horrible word you can possibly think of, and then come home at night and they're like, do you want to watch Lord of the Rings? I'm like, no, I don't want to watch Lord of the Rings. I want to cry. So
my wife went to grad school for social work. And so for in a condensed program with no time off. And so for 2 years straight with like no more than a week's vacation or so, you know, at a time, she spent all day.
That's
all goddamn day just listening and talking about suicide and addiction and trauma and abandonment and grief and loss. And holy shit, do you know like what it does to you? I mean, you do.
It'll mess
and
you
it's
up.
Like, I think we don't realize that. And I think it's also something that I think we're getting better about it as a society, because I think more sensitive people are coming into power in the right positions way more than we used to have. And so now I think people headed towards a life or a career that includes so much secondhand trauma, whether it's editing films about atrocious things or helping people with horrific problems or, you know, investigating horrific things for the sake of law enforcement or whatever. It's like, we are thankfully, I think, maybe not as good as we can, and we need to keep working on it, but we are at least packaging that a little bit more with like, make sure you do some self-care, make sure you're aware this is not a harmless thing just because it's not happening to you.
100%.
Just thinking about that shit all the time. And I think that that is another conversation that they're continuing to have too. And even in the acting world, because it's like, you think about this and it's changed so much since I was in the drama school. So I'm not speaking at all as to how it is now. I have to say that like every time I talk about it, because I don't know. And I just went to homecoming and like watched an acting class, and some of it was the same. So it was super not fucking same. And so, but at the time it's like, we'd be like 19 years old and we'd be like sitting there with the lights dimmed to where we can barely kind of see what's in front of us. And we're wearing a mask and we've created a whole illusion for ourselves where someone just got like assaulted, or we got in a fight, or we're about to die because it's the apocalypse or whatever. And we're really trying to trick ourselves into believing that that situation is real, because that's what we're there to learn how to be good at. And wow. It's like, yeah, it's like you need to couple that with some like, let's all aftercare and let's all like go do something about that. And you have to do that when you work on these kinds of projects, or it will do exactly what it did to you and start to like numb you and make things not fun that used to be fun and zap you of the joy that used to be with. That's the reason you did that at that volume in the first place, is because there was something you liked about it.
Exactly. And I was once told, after working on a couple of sexual assault documentaries in a row, I asked why these people kept hiring me. And they said, it's because you're probably one of the only AEs we've ever had that can still come to work the next day smiling after watching all of this stuff, which I appreciated, because I understand that that meant to them, I was someone that they felt safe around. And, you know, we would cry together if we had to watch that footage. And at the end of the day, I was always like, I'm getting through this because people need to be heard. And I appreciate that sentiment. And I really do. I took that compliment to heart. But it did get to a point where it's like, but there's pressure on me to be that. I don't get a paycheck if I'm not like that. I don't get to pay rent if I'm not like that. And I found a group of people who all had the same job. It was on accident. We didn't mean to get together for this reason, but we figured out together that we had all had this shared experience. One of my closest friends in LA now, they worked on the documentary about R. Kelly, and bonding with them has been really special because we have this unique experience no one ever talks about, which is being an assistant editor, watching all of the raw footage of really atrocious things. And talking to them and, you know, recovering through them and with them has been really interesting because it's not something we talk about. And there's all this rhetoric online, which is deserved, of people saying most documentaries now are torture porn and like they just want to make you like they're using the victim stories for attention and all this. And while I don't doubt that for some people that's very real, I can go ahead and tell you that every single person I've worked with in post-production who works on documentaries about really traumatizing things, all of them are doing it for the most genuine reason on earth. Like, I have never met a person who's trying to alter the story. I've never met a person who's doing it for attention. The only times I've ever felt like we changed the story to make it more jarring was because we felt like someone truly needed to be called out and we were going to do whatever we could to get our victims justice by really emphasizing the terrible things they've done. So it's my experience of working in that side of the industry has been overwhelmingly positive people, really stressful work environment, you know, with no health insurance that really heavily affects your life outside of work. But the product, like the first thing I worked on was called Seduced Inside the NXIVM Cult. It's on Stars. It's a 4-part documentary. And when it came out a couple months later, a cult leader was in prison. And like knowing that I'm literally getting chills, knowing that our documentary had something to do with that. I genuinely don't think there is ever going to be anything that will replicate that feeling for me. Like, it was so special to be like, you know, we had survived the pandemic. Like, we finished it during the pandemic. We turned it in, I believe, in 2021. We all got together and we got to watch it together. And it was just really, really emotional. And just knowing that, like, we had created this thing through a time of struggle to help women who had been through some of the worst stuff you can ever imagine. And yeah, it was incredible. And it was a really wonderful experience at the end of the day. And I'm so glad I did it. But I just am not the kind of person who can handle that as a full-time career. And that's okay. And I can tell those stories in other ways. But yeah.
Yeah, but no one could take away from you that memory of him hiding in that closet in Mexico like a little bitch. Like, yo.
You've seen it? Oh my God.
Yeah, I followed that whole story. That's the one I've seen. That's the one I've seen. I'm not going to lie. But yo, that's 100%. And okay, so here's my next question, because we only have so much more time, but I want to get to this as well, because you mentioned this earlier and we've talked about this big shift of, you know, away from documentary, and you're working on scripted stuff now out of a combination of necessities, financial and emotional. I feel like you speak about this change with an amount of permanence that I'm curious how much you mean to speak of it that way versus how much you give yourself permission to return to this kind of work at a later date when those two things may be different in your life.
So this is something I think about a lot.
I bet.
And I am the kind of person who in a perfect world would split it 50-50, because I do really like scripted. I really like the actual process is really interesting and new to me, and I'm enjoying it a lot. But in the world of posts, there is a very, very, very big, clear divide between unscripted and scripted. And there is animosity on both sides. And there is, they don't know what they're doing. Well, they don't know what they're doing, to the point that they usually won't hire you unless you have a string in a row of a certain kind of film. I know an editor who is so cool and so great. He edited Euphoria. His name's Aaron Butler, and he is so cool, and I love him. And his work is incredible. And he was a documentary filmmaker. He edited documentaries for a very long time. His first scripted thing, he speaks about this on so many different podcasts. It's so easy to hear him tell the story. And if you're interested, you should, because it sounds so much better coming out of his mouth than mine. But his first scripted thing was Euphoria. And he was hired because the director really liked his editing work and recognized his documentary editing style as something that would be really beneficial for Euphoria. And then he won an Emmy about it. And then he got recognized about it. And then he got all this attention about it. And then everyone figured out he's amazing, and he steadily works in scripted now. But if someone as talented as he is had that much of a hard time switching over, and obviously I can't speak for how hard it was, but just judging by his story and the fact that no one would even give him a chance until he got to work on Euphoria, it really speaks volumes about how heavily people try to separate these two sides of post-production. And when I'm in a place in my life in which I'm comfortable saying I'll do both, maybe that's something I'll return to. But until then, I've got to put all my cookies in one basket. Like, it really has to be scripted, scripted, scripted until I get to a point in which, in my head, what ends up happening is I go, I want to tell a story. There's a story I want to tell. I don't want to get hired on someone else's documentary. I'm like, maybe I start directing them when I have the space to be able to do that. Which is not right now, but like, I'm in my 20s. We got time.
Andy, and you know what? I say this with so much respect. The answer that you just gave me was very much someone in their 20s, and not till the very end did you get to what I meant, which is just that you at some point can make whatever the fuck you want to make.
Eventually.
The burdens of what you're dealing with in this moment are no longer the immediate things that you have to deal with for whatever reason, because things evolve for all sorts of different reasons. I think you make a tremendously important point about the isolation. And we have talked about this mostly with filmmakers and people in production, a little bit with like drama students who also work in production. But yeah, I've told the story many times on this show about how I've been a reality TV producer for years. And there was a period where I was in between stuff, and I'd already worked on so many different things. And I'd really kind of started to carve out my resume as like competitive reality, where there'd mm-hmm. some sort of contest. And I was trying to get on these baking shows. It was like three different baking shows that were like competitive reality. There's fucking a million of them. There's even more now than there was then. But back then mm-hmm. there was a lot. And I sent my resume into three different shows who all sent it back through somebody else, basically being like, they're going to talk to these other people because you don't have any competitive baking reality TV show experience. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, what?
Yeah.
That's the craziest shit. Holding a camera and being like, you know, but also holding a camera for a producer, right? You piece of shit. Holding a camera and being like, hey, how you doing on the jive versus like how you doing on that sponge cake is the same fucking thing.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
I don't need to. So girl, believe me, I hear you on yeah. they won't let you hop around so easily.
Yeah.
What I'm pointing to is like, for example, the reason I'm very much like you, I went to TV and even more specific to reality TV because I need a paycheck. I really, yeah. really needed one. And I had nobody else to bail me out. I needed to find a way to get health insurance somehow and do it like to piece it together. That's how I started off ending up like where I am now. But I used to want to direct plays. I liked yeah. doing that. That's what my degree is in. I miss it all the fucking time, but I'm not delusional and to think that I'm going to get hired to direct a play. I'm going to have to be an assistant director for like 15 years before mm-hmm. they'll let me do it. And then also it's theater. So I'm going to beg 100 people to come to it every time. And get, I'll be lucky if I make any money, you know, at all.
Yeah.
So that, hoping that skill set would translate was foolish. They don't give a shit. They just don't get it, which is so crazy because people like us know that first year of school where we went to school built a foundation of, I can do lots of different shit and I don't have to pigeon myself, you know, pigeonhole myself into this one thing forever. And you're going to have a fucking documentary that you need to make.
Oh, it'll happen. It's already happening in my head.
Fuck yeah. Well, and that's why I asked you. That's why I asked you, like, when you speak about it with this way that sounds so permanent of like, I am no longer someone who does this. It's just curious to me because it sounds like maybe closer to what you mean is like, for now, that's not my focus, but you're still going to be like a documentary chick. And you're, you know, like that's who you are. That's so who you are.
Oh, if you look at my Netflix history, you now can see.
Yeah. Like, now that you like, can you watch can movies tell. Again.
Exactly. And there was a part of that that I missed being the girl that wanted to talk about docs. I didn't want to talk about docs anymore, you know?
Sure.
So it's, I'm still finding my balance of everything right now. Get this. This is so left field. I'm working in the costume department right now because it's the strike and nothing is real. So I'm like, the fact that I'm able to hop into a costume department and like, while I don't know anything, I'm learning. That is a department that like needs so much more respect thrown on its name than it has right now. I at least am adaptable and they can show me how to do stuff. And it is a survival job, but it's a survival job that everyone there is rooting me on for. They think it's so like left field that I'm there, but they're happy to have me. And I love listening to their stories and learning from them. And I'm like, thank God I went to a school that didn't just teach me editing because I just need a job right now. And there aren't actors to film the part that I need to be able to edit it, you know?
Yeah, so. No, I know exactly what you mean. And can I give you a compliment?
Go for it.
You have such like wardrobe department vibes.
Oh, that is the biggest compliment I've gotten. That's amazing.
You so do. Roxy, you're so a wardrobe department gal on the outside.
And I love that.
Yeah, I mean that absolutely. I would 100% be like, who can hem this? And I would be like, you've got to know how to do that, right?
Oh, don't give me a needle. Let me just go ahead and say, in theory, I can give whatever you need. I can give it to someone who can do it to you, but absolutely do not allow me around anything sharp if you care for your life.
Copy that.
Yeah. Copy but that. It's fun. They're such an incredible
thing you
department.
Cut is footage.
Exactly. Exactly. No, literally there's like, They're so fun. They have little like tassels and stuff on the scissors that we can use that aren't fabric scissors. Cause one day I'm gonna grab a fabric scissors and try to do something
don't do
with
it.
Them. And I can't.
They're called
I'm scared.
And don't you do it.
Oh, you know, you're aware.
I can love. Sew. That's one of my backup skills. I was raised by two grandmothers who were both like very serious at sewing, one of them even more so than the other. So
that's
I was feeding stuff through from a young age.
Well, if you ever apparently need like a random side quest, I highly recommend joining the wardrobe department. They are fun.
I'm about it.
And they dress, oh my goodness. In post, there's literally jokes about the fact that we don't wear real clothes to work. Like you go to the Eddies and they're every single time I've been to the Eddies, one of the first jokes is, I have never seen you guys wear real pants before. And we're like, aha, we're wearing dresses. And at this department, they show up heels.
Yeah.
Like full blown, all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, I'm not used to this. Like I have to wake up an extra 30 minutes early so that I can.
Don't you remember that they were already on that shit when we were at school and D&P like wardrobe and the wig and makeup girls and all that? Man, they're so badass.
D&P people, I thought they were like extra levels of cool. I was like, I barely knew any of them, but from afar, I was like, y'all, you know, like, I don't know what you know, but you know something I don't know.
Respect in both categories, but especially the designers. My God, no matter what department you were in, if you're a designer, it was like you were required to look like you belong on a Magic the Gathering card. You had to have you had to have your own legendary creature vibe every day. It was fucking
not
insane.
Not the Magic the Gathering card. That's amazing.
Am I right?
So
it would
real.
Be like
you're so right.
Lapels coming off like this, and like feathers, or like a
Well, every time. Always remember what something that I really liked about you and CSA in theory the whole time was that we got to wear whatever we wanted to graduation. And I was like, yeah. I can't wait. And then, of course, I'm a girly pop that the morning after I graduated was on my way to the LA trip. So I wore a dress that was thin enough to just be able to place on top of my suitcase. And then you've got the costume designers.
Right.
And they show up. Like they've been thinking about this for 4 years. And then everyone in film is like, we just kind of have this on. And I'm like, I wish I had gone. I look back on my graduation photos and I'm like, there is such a missed opportunity there, Roxy, but that's okay. We'll get them next time.
Like, my wife has worn a cap and gown like 4 times. She would like grad school, undergrad, high school. And then, I think she wore one for like middle school or some goofy shit, elementary or something. I don't know. But we've talked about it all the time. I've never worn a cap and gown in my life. And I
not even high school.
I didn't walk in high school because I didn't have enough hours. So I wasn't allowed to walk at graduation because I was tardy too much and absent and skipped school all the fucking time. I got my diploma. I haven't brought this up in a while, so I'll tell everybody in case you missed this. This is the degenerate that you were listening to on At the Elephants all these years. You didn't know. No, this is my favorite. I'm almost weirdly proud of it. So this is how I graduated high school. I graduated in the bottom fifth, not the bottom fourth, bottom fifth, bottom 20 percentile of my graduating class in grades. And I was handed... I was handed my diploma by the vice principal in July in the office of an empty school after I peeled off a rubber glove that I had been taking out the trash with, because that's how I had to spend my whole summer, was cleaning the school so I could make up the hours so that they could give me my diploma. So when I finally did it, I walked into the office at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I took the glove off and he's like, all right, you're done. Here you go. And I was like, thanks. I'm going to go home now.
Well, that says so much too about, like, we were talking way earlier about like how people put shame on trade school's name and all this stuff. And I think a big part of the reason that a lot of people go to UNCSA is they see the U in the front of it. And they're like, look, that's a place I can get an arts education, but I won't be a failure to society because I will have a university degree. And I'm over here like, none of this matters. All this school stuff. If there's one thing I wish I could go back and tell my high school self, I'm like, you have gifts in certain areas. It's okay that you suck at math. Like you, it's fine that I never took like that. Yeah. Took to math or science or history or any of that. I had really clear strengths and I've taken those strengths and I found a school that would nurture them. And when I was in a school that would nurture them, I succeeded. And from there, I was able to live a life that I'm genuinely happy. I'm genuinely happy. I've got 2 cats. I've got my cute little apartment. Usually I have a job that isn't posted that I like. I can still do photography because for some crazy reason, people out here still hire me to photograph weddings. I thought that I would have to give that up and I didn't have to, which has been great.
People never stop getting married, baby.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. It's eternal. And I get to know when people are getting engaged ahead of time. That's my favorite part of being the one wedding photographer in the USA, UNCSA community, is I find out people are like, hey, I'm going to propose. I'm like, you're going to propose. No one else knows. Oh my God. It's great. But it's like when you're in schools that nurture that, when you're in social situations that nurture that, you don't feel super stupid for not having a 4.5 weighted GPA at the second highest ranking high school in North Carolina. You don't need to be someone that excels in everything to be able to excel in what you want to excel in. And I just really wish more people talked about that. And they say it in theory, but actually being able to be a person who's like lived that experience and seen my friends live that experience, like seeing it, like, look at you, you're freaking producing reality TV. That's so cool. Like, you, yeah, it's good okay job. I like that it. You got handed a diploma. Like, I'm sure in high school that felt a certain kind of way and no one cares. No one cares.
Here's the thing, Roxy, and I want to be clear about this because this is what's fucked up. I feel like the right thing to do is to be like, you know, as it turned out, that's not how I feel. That would be disingenuous and not true. I knew I was right a whole fucking time when I was such an arrogant little prick, and I had lots to learn about humbling myself. So I've done a lot of that. But from a young age, the reason that I fucked off in school and I skipped class, and the reason I was good at most of those subjects you mentioned, I wasn't like bad at school, like knowledge wise. I took all the standardized tests and would do well. I didn't do my homework. I didn't show up. I just like didn't participate in school. And so they would be like, all right, it's the last day of class and here's your exam. And I'd be like, cool, boom. And they'd be like, all right, great, A minus, whatever the fuck. And they'd be like, where's your essay? And I was like, what? I don't know about that. And they're like, dude, you're supposed to be working on that. It's 80% of your grade, whatever the fuck. And I'd be like, ah, I don't know. I have no idea what you're talking about. And then they'd be like, okay, so you're going to fail. And I'd be like, okay. Like, I just wasn't, I couldn't be bothered about it. And it was weird because I had such a split experience where people were constantly telling me that that attitude was not right. And then I had other people in my life who were like, you're so funny. I really liked you in that play. And I'm like, yeah. I'm good with that. That's enough for me. These people being like, you're a loser because you don't do the homework or whatever. I'm like, nah, I think they're wrong. And they told me I couldn't graduate. My family was fucking pissed. They were so pissed. My mom didn't graduate high school at all. My dad didn't walk because he graduated in December, like a little early because he was like working and stuff. So they wanted me to fucking graduate and walk across the stage. And it was a big deal. Some people are worried about college. They just wanted me to graduate high school. And I fucked that up. They were not happy with me. But I promised them at the time, I was like, this is a long arc thing. I just have to figure it out. And it's funny that you mentioned the U. When I got accepted and when I applied, there was no U.
Right. Because they changed that.
The U happened while I was on campus, while I was a student. And I fought it. I wore a little pin that had the U with the little Ghostbusters thing through it. And I told everybody, fuck the U. I did the protests and all that kind of stuff, knowing we would lose. It was about money. There's nothing we could do. But to me, I had nothing but pride about the trade school I got into because that's what I thought of it as. Yeah, I was going to go there for lighting also because I was like 98% job rate and I'm going to do lights on cruise ships or some shit.
You were in a lot of departments.
I started in lighting and then I moved to drama directing. That's where I graduated from.
That's so rad.
But it was, which is also a design thing because you take DMP classes while you're in the directing program. But
right.
So it was kind of DMP drama hybrid thing. It worked out really well for me. Uniquely, but my point is I'm very anti all the shit that you just said about the prestige, and I'll get it because of the U and I need the paper. I've never cared about the paper. I don't know where my high school did that diploma they gave. I think I gave it to my mom years ago. I don't know the fuck it is. I don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I was taught by the system, and maybe this is part of what you've experienced with other people and you've developed this for yourself. I was told by the system really early to give up on myself because I didn't do what they told me to do. They're like, if you're not going to do this, you should just give up and, I don't know, do drugs on the side of the street. I don't know, give up. They told me just to give up. And I was convinced that that wasn't the case. And in the long run, I kind of proved myself right. And I kind of proved them wrong of like, and also my only bitterness is like, why did you tell me to fucking give up? Why didn't you just tell me go do this shit instead?
Yeah.
I feel like the big lesson here is that the stakes are so much lower than we realize when we're young.
Yeah.
It doesn't 100%. Matter. 100%. Doesn't matter. Like, what matters is what you think of yourself, what you think of what you can do, how kind you are, shit like that. And it's like, those lessons are pretty fucking important. I feel like maybe we should be working a little harder to talk about shit like that. You seem to get these things.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. I also had the extra sprinkling of first generation on top.
Right.
Which, like, right. I'm sure you know my wife. The whole. Yeah.
Her parents are immigrants. Yeah.
It's this whole extra special concoction of we did a lot of work, so you have to succeed in this country. And thank God. So my mom is from the South, born and raised. Like, we go back generations. My
North dad's Carolina, the one who's South?
First. Yeah, literally specifically in North Carolina.
Yeah, Texas, like eight generations. Yeah,
exactly. It's like it's an interesting. I don't like to tell people I'm half white. I like to tell people I'm half yeehaw, because like it's a specific kind of white. Like I'm like, it's not just white. Like you need to understand.
I really like that. I might be taking that because I'm like 80% yeehaw girl.
There you go. See, yeah. that's how we need to be talking about this stuff. But my parents shared really, really similar values. And my mom didn't come from money, so she worked hard because of that. And my dad came from the Middle East, so he worked hard because of that. And there was this pressure on me to be
how
like...
How old was he when he immigrated?
I believe he was 20.
How did he immigrate?
So he fought in the Iran-Iraq war because he was drafted.
Got it.
Because he had to. He was a medic because his feet were too short to touch the pedals.
Hilarious.
Driving things. Yes, he's 5'3". He's shorter than me.
Amazing.
And so he went to France first because he just had to, you know, he wanted to get out of the country, him and his brother. And then after he went to France, he was like, all right, I got to come to the States. Still don't really know what made him make that decision, but he did. So
he came.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. he ended up meeting
he's like,
up
I heard about Carrie.
Yeah, no. Well, no. See, this is what actually happened. My great uncle had moved here first. He's the one that found Carrie. He literally was like, what is
this?
This
is your dad's
town?
Dad's brother?
Dad's mom's brother.
Dad's mom's brother. Got it.
Yeah. Found Carrie, said, this is the safest place. I found the safest place in the States. So then my dad came and moved to Carrie with him, and he was the ice cream guy. My uncle had an ice cream truck business, and my dad was the ice cream truck guy. And that's, he met my mom when he was doing ice cream truck stuff. And she was a scientist who had started her career, and she was like, this is it. And they are still obsessed with each other 30 years later.
That is such a cool story.
It's so sweet. They met because someone was being super racist to my dad, and my mom walked up and was like, leave him alone. And yeah. And he was in school. He was the ice cream truck guy getting his degree. She was a scientist in the beginning of her career. And now he has a PhD and he's an engineer.
In ice cream?
Totally. No, textiles.
Damn. I was like, yeah. I almost found out about the coolest guy who ever lived just now. But he sounds still, he's pretty cool still.
That's he's fine. Still good. Yeah, he's yeah, still that's fine. But no, they're
you
awesome.
You could be
they're
a doctor of like fabrics and materials.
Yeah, believe it or not, that's an option. His thesis was on the, what does my mom say? Hairiness of yarn is what she says. I don't know what that means, but it's the story I've been fed since I was a child. So I just regurgitate it.
I have a joke that I just wrote for your dad.
Please.
He should tell everyone that he's had a great career in textiles, but he can't wait to retire.
Fucking goodbye. I'm dead. I'll go text him that after this. I'll let him know. I'll let him know you said
that's free.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, they're sweet. But they did have a lot of pressure on me to academically succeed. And I think when they saw me going in the art direction, they were confused. But the second they saw that, they didn't have an option.
But they have faith, clearly. I mean, you've come good on the, hey, give me a shot of all this because you've been editing.
Yeah, they definitely, it's actually been really sweet. The strike has been very hard on me, both financially, emotionally, identity wise, like all this stuff. And my parents have always pushed me very hard. But during the strike, when I finally, for the first time in my adult life, was able to express to them, I'm scared. All of a sudden they were like, we believe in you so hard. Like, you're going to be fine. Look at the life you've built. And I'm like, where has this been? Like, they were holding on to it, but it's something about me, like having lived out here for 4 years by myself and like actually doing the thing and succeeding. I finally convinced them that this was the right thing. And then they revealed they had always believed that. They just, you know, were being parents about it. So
have you heard of this doc called My So-Called High School Rank?
No.
I really think that you'll like it. I mean, if I don't know how critical you are of documentaries, I can't attest to when one is good or bad because I'm kind of an easy audience member. But there's a really, and I would recommend this to everybody because it's super relevant to the themes that are on this podcast all the time. And I think it's fascinating. This is a doc. It is on Max, I think. It's HBO produced or something, but it is maybe. So everything's on Max now, and I don't know who the fuck made it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we used to be like, it's on that. So that's who. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, it is on Max. It is good. It is about a high school, I think, in NorCal that is dealing with the stuff that you were talking about of the high expectations of the school, because the school is like super, prestigious. Hard to get into. I think it was private school, but yeah, it's one of those like Harvard Westlake, like one of those like pre Ivy League high schools, and everybody, you know, it's right outside of Silicon Valley. That's what it was. And so it's all of these, you know, first, second generation immigrant kids with that pressure. That is like so many of the kids going to this school.
I need to watch this.
Work in tech, and they write a musical. The drama department writes a musical about the pressure, and holy shit, they have an app on their phone that shows them their rank. And after they like take a test, it'll be like, boop, you went up, you went down. And they're freaking the fuck out about
this.
It
is
every
a doc?
Day.
This is real?
This is a real thing. So they make a musical about it, and they literally are about to take it to fucking Broadway. They're like auditioning actors in New York to like take this and blow it up. And that was fucking like 2020 in the spring. So it kills it. They end up producing the musical on Zoom and making a whole movie. But it's a great, great, great story. And one of the things that really just hit home for me, and I hope you watch this, and I hope other people who have this experience watch this, definitely affected my wife. Anyone who has that immigrant experience, that children of immigrant experience, which is, there's this one kid in the movie who's just like tripping about how hard his dad is on him, and he's like, it's never enough for him, you know. And they're not combative, they like are really loving with each other, but there is this pressure, and they're like cleaning the fucking Lamborghini or whatever the dad has. They're like pot waxing it together, and he's like, you know, so you got second or whatever, it's like, but you could get first. And the kid's like, yeah, you know, I want to, I'm gonna try. And they're having this contentious thing. And then there's this day where he's like graduating high school, and the kid is like, my dad's not really an emotional guy. This is like an on the fly interview. He's like, he's not really an emotional guy. Like, he's here to support me. You know, I feel like it was a bigger deal for my brother to graduate, but his older brother. And then it cuts to the dad, and he's like a really, they clearly don't talk. He's like, I hope he understands how big of a deal this is to me and how proud of him I am. It's not an easy thing to talk about, but like, this is a very emotional day for me. He like literally directly contradicts the impression that the kid has. And it's like, they're both doing their best. So it's not about placing blame, but it is about like, also one of the things I think we take for granted as Americans, and I work on a reality show that is very American culture versus other culture. And so we constantly talk about the differences. And one of the things we take for granted in America is how rapidly and recently we have started to talk about our feelings in this country.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes.
We just started to do it.
Crazy.
We just started to do it. Nobody knows how. Most people aren't very good about it. And one of the worst things that happens is we hold other cultures and other people, even Americans that live in different parts of the country, responsible for the fact that they haven't caught up with this new thing about talking about your fucking feelings, because almost no one else in the world does it like we do it at all.
Yeah.
They don't know how. For thousands of years, they've been using an unchanged language that might be fucking ancient. And they've been speaking in that language, and that language may not even be built to talk about fucking feelings. And they don't evolve the way English does. So they don't just come up with new words to express how they're feeling today. Like, that's not built into old languages. Yeah.
No.
And so
it's part of
putting those things together is tough.
Yeah. It's part of the reason that I'm so like open on the internet. I get comments from people of varying degrees of disappointment. when I'll be relatively vulnerable online about the way I feel about something, because I grew up in a place where it wasn't okay to have feelings.
Right.
And it's, I'm sure you have a similar experience of sometimes you'll just be talking about your day, but because you work in film, people think you're bragging, where you're like,
yeah,
oh my gosh, I had to go to set at 6 a.m. And someone's like, well, at least you got to work on set and you're exhausted and you're running on 3 hours of sleep and you were just trying to complain about your day. There's this thought, this idea from people that don't work in the film industry, that every time we talk about our lives, we're bragging. And I just really want everyone to know, especially because I have a TikTok platform in which most people don't know me from school, don't know me from home. They just know me as this girl on the internet. And I want people to know that, like, people who work in these jobs, people who have this life, people who whatever, we're just freaking people. And people are allowed to have feelings. And people in this country are allowed to express how they're feeling, because if you do it, someone else will do it back to you. And we need to create more spaces where we're intentional about letting people feel things. And I'm really grateful I work in an industry in which it's our job to feel things, because I found a lot of other people who are willing to be super open. And you're on your first day of work and they're talking about, oh yeah, insert the most traumatic thing you've ever heard. And you're like, same. Like, you can bond over things like this. And then I go home to visit and I realize there's places in the country that are not quite caught up yet. And no wonder people are going to judge you for being emotional online. You know what I mean? But
the empathy has to go both ways, right? Like, we have to hope that more people will empathize and sympathize with some of our, I'm with you, need to express that. But the empathy has to go back towards the other people who don't get that and are not wired that way. And we're taught that that's actually a really dangerous vulnerability that could cause you damage. It could be a bad thing to go too far with that.
Oh, 100%.
I don't agree with them, but I respect the fact that is hard baked into what they believe the world is and how they think they should protect themselves. So we have to do both. But at the same time, honestly, Roxy, I think there's a little bit of power, and I want people to know that too, but I don't feel that pressure to, like, not brag or whatever, because I'm still the same kid who didn't care about graduating. Like, I know I'm not bragging.
No, I'm definitely getting better about it.
It's
had
tough.
Some people make me feel nasty for it, but now I'm getting over it, because I realized I'm just like, I just want to connect with people. And the longer people know me, if people know me in real life and not just by the internet, they'll know that I'm just a girl who likes to talk.
Well, and the internet is not set up in a way to make sure people are supported emotionally. That's like, that is so obviously one of the bugs of this machine that we are all a part of. It's not built for your safety or your comfortability. It is simply built for attention. And usually the thing that drives attention the most, unfortunately, is animosity and judgment and shame and, you know, I work in reality TV. It's like half of our business model, or I should say half of the business model of most reality TV in my experience is to instigate, you know, intense positive, but also mostly negative feelings amongst the audience. They want to upset everyone so that they feel they must rush to whatever platform they can to voice their frustration or anger at these people on screen that really maybe did or even didn't do the fucking thing that you're all upset about. And it is a fool's errand to try to tell them, hey, these are people too. You gotta take their feelings into consideration. These are real people. They're not actors. You're right. But to try to get them to get that is not only a fool's errand, it is contradictory to what they are interested in. They are there to hate. if they have the capacity to be a judgmental person who calls you out for bragging and makes you feel nasty, if they have that in them to get out, if it's not you, it's going to be somebody else. If they have more knowledge about you being a regular person, or knowing that just because you go to set, that doesn't mean this, that, or the other, that knowledge is not going to affect their need to be nasty. It's going to happen to someone else on some other issue. So we can talk all day about getting them to get it. They're not going to get it. They don't want to get it. They're nasty. They want to be nasty. And they need a They need a misunderstanding to lean on. So, because if they really got to the root of everything they want to be nasty about, they'd find out there's real people that deserve empathy at the core of it. They don't want to do that work though, girl.
Yeah. Someone
told
me.
Take it away.
I don't know if someone told me, but I recently learned that being corrected activates the same part of your brain as physical pain. So like when people are told something they don't believe in and they have to come to terms with it, it literally
hurts.
Mentally is similar to physical pain. So I think it gets to a point where I'm always willing to have a conversation with someone. But I also have spent my entire upbringing as someone who contradicted most of the things that were okay in the South.
You've been putting yourself through that pain for a long time. You're very comfortable with it.
Yeah. And I'm not willing to do it anymore. I'm too grown. And so I will talk to someone until I realize they won't listen. And then at that point, I will let it go. And whether that's about, hey, you're bragging, no, I'm not, or your political beliefs are wrong, no, it's not, your religious beliefs, no, it's not. Like, I'll get to a point where I love having conversations with people because I like to learn why they think the way they think. In fact, I kind of hyperfixate on it sometimes. If someone really disagrees with me, I do deep dives on how they can possibly believe what they believe because I just want to know how someone can think like that. But it's so easy
for me to jump to people are stupid and I get out of it right away. I'm like, oh,
I mean, that's probably
you're like
healthier
a,
to be honest.
You're like a dumb person.
I can't. No, I recently
I'm
learned
too
the
arrogant.
Other day, every time I see someone on the freeway driving weird, I always go, that person's stupid. And my partner always goes, that person's drunk. And I think about that sometimes with life. I'm like, sometimes people assume people are dumb and other people are like, they made a poor decision.
Granted. It's one of those three things, right? Like the person cuts you off on the road. They're either dumb, they're drunk, or they're in labor, right? They've got something going on that you're like,
that
God damn. It's got to be one of those three things. If it's not, then they're just an asshole.
I did avoid getting my plates changed for quite a while after I moved here because I wanted people to know I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I was like, see my license plate? I'm not from here. Be nice to me. I'm trying my best.
And I think we all assume that that's everybody anyway. I tell my wife that all the time because she's from here. She's like from Calabasas and grew up like, you know, driving into LA all the time, like every day.
Oh, wow.
Her parents work in Koreatown. And so it was like, she's very, very from LA and she gets frustrated on the road with the way people drive. And I was like, you have to remember that most people driving around don't fucking know their way around.
Yeah.
And for the last 20 years, everybody's used a GPS and literally no one knows how to get anywhere. They're all just like, I don't know. Ah, Siri. And then they fucking, you know.
Oh, my goodness. If
reservoir.
Your phone dies in LA, you're lost. That's it. Like, how do you get home? How do you? It's dangerous. Like, it's yeah, that's a side note. That's a whole other thing.
But you like it here.
I love it. Oh, my God. I'm so happy. Like, well. Okay, I'm usually so happy the strike's done a number on my mental health. But
sure.
Other than that, in terms of like the life I live, the people in my life, like I don't think I realized how unhappy I was until I came here and had, I sat in a restaurant with my cultural food on the menu for the first time in my life and just cried because I realized I didn't know how to spell any of the words because I'd never seen them on paper. Or the first time I heard Farsi in public, I also cried because I realized I'd never heard that language outside the walls of my house. Or
right.
The first time I met someone who openly identified as bisexual was out here, blew my mind. Hey, like other things like that. There's like so many things. It's so many parts of me that I didn't realize I was missing out on because I didn't have access to it because I was alone at home. And like out here, there's a club for everything. There is people who are into everything on earth and it's so easy to find things to go to. And if it's Friday and you're bored, it's so easy to find somewhere to go. And I have the best friends I've ever had in my life. I have pets and a place that's my own. And like my sister's coming to visit and she can. But like it's an option for me to have my family come see me. And I'm just really happy. It's been an interesting year for a lot of reasons for me. But in general, I love Los Angeles so much and I do not plan on leaving anytime soon. I've told people I knew that I belonged here when I realized during the pandemic, you know, I thought, what if I never work in film again? Like, what if I don't make movies anymore? And I realized I was okay with it. I was like, I want to make movies. That's my career goal. That's what I would like, but I wouldn't leave. If that option left me, I would not leave LA. I would stay right where I was and just make it work. So,
well, I don't think we're going to top that. I think that's a good place to leave it. This has been so fun. We went way longer than I planned, but I really like talking to you. This was super fun and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Awesome. Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
You know it. We'll have you back on soon and we'll catch up. Hopefully once the strikes and all that, we really get that wrapped up. We're kind of in between. We got one done. Hopefully we're done with the other one pretty soon and you'll be hopefully back to doing this scripted stuff. And, you know, we'll come back on. We'll talk about how that develops for you once that's the thing you've been doing for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. I'm down.